28. Waking up for an early class? That's hard. Voting is easy. You can register and vote on campus from April 13th to 16th. And don't forget to bring accepted ID. Check elections.ca to find out where and when you can vote.
It's sort of a supreme irony here that we have now the technology so that not that many people have to work and we can produce a lot. We have the technology so we can address the vexing environmental problems with probably far less of a cost than we're going to probably have to end up paying. We have the technology so that we can have a much higher standard of living. The output per worker is radically higher than it was 50 years ago. Yet our standard of living for most people is lower. There's endless calls for cutbacks and stagnation at the same time. This enormous paradox, and it's only understood by understanding the problems built into the way capitalism works.
That's Robert McChesney, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Robert McChesney on capitalism in the age of digital technology. Monopoly isn't just a board game. It's the animating dynamic of our economic system. Really existing capitalism, which relies heavily on taxpayer support, embodies a near genetic drive to consolidate, to dominate, and ultimately to eliminate competition. This leaves people with fewer choices and higher prices, exactly the outcome desired by the monopolists. Democracy, particularly in the United States, has largely morphed into an oligarchy run by and for plutocrats. As corporate control of media increases, and as inequality widens, and as the eco-crisis continues apace, one can expect a future of social unrest. Our guest today is Robert McChesney, a leading media historian and public intellectual. He was co-founder of Free Press, a nonprofit organization working to increase public participation in media policy debates. His work focused on the role of journalism and democracy in a capitalist system. An activist scholar, he was a champion of independent progressive media. A prolific author, among his many books are Rich Media, Poor Democracy, and Digital Discontent. Noam Chomsky said, "Robert McChesney's work has been of extraordinary importance. It should be read with care and concern by people who care about freedom and basic rights." This classic from the AR archives was recorded at the University of Wisconsin at Madison in 2015. And now, Robert McChesney.
You know, there have been three great definitional communication revolutions in the human experience. And I use the term experience because one of them is prehistory. The first one, of course, is the development of language or speech, which distinguishes human beings, Homo sapiens, from all the other hominids that evolved out of the chimpanzees, the best we can tell. And the best we can tell is probably as good an explanation as we have any why we're the only ones who made it. And all the others basically bit the dust. We're the last hominid standing. So speech and language was a big deal. It created us as a species. As Aristotle said, we're the talking animal. The second great development in communication, revolution, if you will, was writing and the alphabet, which came a few thousand years ago over time. But it really changed everything. I mean, it made it possible for human societies, after they had agriculture, to expand much more outward, to build the great empires of Egypt and Greece and Rome, China and India. Writing was mandatory for that. And it also opened up possibilities for rational thought, science, that were unthinkable without the ability to write. So it's not an entirely coincidence that just a few centuries after the first phonetic alphabet, we see ancient classical Athens emerge, fully a society that is right there at the transition from an oral society in Socrates to a writing society. You can see the excitement there as these two conflicting systems of communication come into play. And then the third great communication revolution is the printing press in the 15th century, which made possible universal literacy, made possible things like the scientific revolution, democracy, advanced industrial economies. Again, all three of these are big deals. All three of these really changed the course of human development, changed our species fundamentally. And I think now the great question is, will the digital revolution be number four? Is it in that league? And if it is the fourth one, consider what the changes brought by the first three were, and understand those are the sort of changes we're about to have. We have just had the surface of the changes in our lives, in our societies going forward. In the last 25 years, as the internet has really developed, especially in the last 20 years, say, or 15 years, there's been a huge literature of people writing books trying to make sense of it. What does this mean? A lot of it's been what I would call celebrants, people who are very excited about it, talk about all the amazing things you can do with technology. And then there are the people who are the skeptics, and these are the people who say, come on, you're exaggerating. Or they're saying, for all the good things it's doing all sorts of bad things too, damaging the quality of our lives. And that's sort of been the range of debate. And most of these books, or not say most, many of them, are interesting. Some of them are fascinating to read. I've read a lot of them. But very few of them really age very well. And they're mostly cocktail party books. They're sort of chit-chat. They're not really serious books about understanding the world to change it. There are very few books that have tried to grab this massive entity and make sense of it. So I volunteered to do that. that's sort of what I did in Digital Disconnect and what I'm doing in that new book, which is called People Get Ready. What I tried to do when looking at the internet was approach the issue rather than as the technology sort of standing outside society, riding roughshod over it, creating a new world in its image, trying to link it to the political economy of advanced capitalism in the United States and the world, the motor forces driving much of this, and then look at the great social questions of our era. Fundamentally, how does the emergence of digital communication affect the way capitalism works, and more importantly, the way capitalism and democracy interact, that nature of that relationship? And this is really the central issue, I believe, for social scientists of our times. Now, this tension between capitalism and democracy, they have a harmonious relationship at times, so they have a very tense relationship at times. They're two very different traditions, distinct traditions, one going back thousands of years, one going back 200 years. Capitalism is a system that's basically a dynamic economic system based on the never-ending and incessant pursuit of maximum private profit. And that's the heart and soul of a capitalist system, by a relatively small number of wealthy people and businesses. Democracy is a system of governance predicated on political equality and dedicated to self-government. At times, again, these work together, but they often conflict. And I'm sort of interested in the conflicts, because I'd like to get rid of them. I'd like democracy to be more successful. So what are the areas where democracy and capitalism have had problems historically throughout the 20th century and earlier, really from the beginning? Well, let's go through a few of the basics. And what I'm about to say is not controversial. This is most of what I'm about to say is in elementary political science texts. It's in, if you read Thomas Jefferson, most of this is in his work. This is pretty standard. This is what you need to make democracy work, and this is what undermines it. First, and most importantly, is inequality. Inequality is cancer for self-government. So obvious, democracy is based on political equality. If you have huge economic inequality, it's very difficult to make it work. Aristotle called democracy the rule of the poor. He said it was when those without property governed. That was where the power lay. And for that reason, you can understand why people with property were never too excited about democracy. For most of it's until quite recently, until the public relations industry came along. If you look at the founding of this country, what's striking is we know how the framers of the U.S. Constitution, they were slave owners, and they were far from perfect beings. But when you actually go back, as I've done for this last book, and read Jefferson and Madison to get their take on inequality, they were both pretty pointed that it was imperative for a democratic government to equalize property ownership, or this whole republic thing can't work. The existing property relations in the United States in their era was inappropriate for a republican or democratic style of government. And so this is really hardwired into democratic theory. Another factor that is antithetical to democracy is economic monopoly. We have private monopolies that dominate the economy. They're going to tend to dominate the politics, too. It's pretty much unavoidable. And pretty much all democratic theory gets that, going back to Jefferson again, who wrote extensively on this issue. Lincoln, it was one of Lincoln's pet causes when he wrote about democracy. And then third, another factor, and this again goes back to the beginning, is militarism. It's impossible to exaggerate just how obsessed the people who started the United States were, not only Jefferson and Madison, but President General George Washington and Alexander Hamilton. They were all obsessed with the idea that we couldn't have a standing military, that militarism was the worst thing for self-government in a free society. And that's why they wrote the Constitution, to make sure we wouldn't have what they call a continual warfare society. Some parts of the Constitution haven't held up as well. That's unfortunately is one of them. But it held up fairly well for much of our history until the 1940s. Now, unfortunately for us, militarism is hardwired into modern capitalism. The Pentagon is as important to capitalism as Wall Street and Madison Avenue. I mean, it is a trillion-dollar grab bag of corporate profits that is there. So that's a real tension in our political economy for democracy. And then all of those combined lead to the growth of corruption and undermining the rule of law, the principle that no one's above the law and no one's below it. Nowadays, to say that, 40 years ago, you would say that with a straight face. Nowadays, it sounds like a punchline to say that, you know, everyone has covered by the law the same in the United States. We all know that's not true. No one even pretends otherwise. There are also certain things that are necessary to make democracy work, to empower people to be effective participants, even if they don't have great wealth. And this is what is called democratic infrastructure. Just like an economy needs an infrastructure, it needs bridges and roads and sewers and transportation for economic activity to take place, democracy has an infrastructure it needs too. Its infrastructure is media systems so people know what's going on, education systems so people are educated, election structures that make it easy to participate effectively. The institutions and resources that enable citizens to participate and enjoy their freedoms and use their freedoms safely. Now, generally, the democratic infrastructure is not a wildly popular thing with people at the upper end of the economic ladder, those who are wealthiest, because they don't want to pay for schools for other people's kids with their taxes. Their kids are going to private schools usually anyway, but they just want to pay for their own kids' schools. They're not as excited about educating everyone else. So that's sort of the lay of the land. Those are the problems between capitalism and democracy. Then the question is, well, how does the internet affect these issues, which all go back to the beginning of capitalism, really. They've existed time immemorial, in effect. One of the celebrants, going back to the early 1990s, the internet was the solution to all these problems. It would basically empower people. It would give them the tools they need to govern the society. They could make an end run around the crappy news media, get the information they needed. It would make capitalism much more competitive. Those big dinosaur corporations could no longer force you to buy their crap at excessive product as you go online and find a better deal. It would make it much more efficient. And it would basically be an extraordinary tool of democracy, egalitarian society. We'd all live happily ever after. And I've got bookshelves of books making this argument in the 1990s. There's still some people making variants of it today. I think they live in caves. I don't know what country they're living in. Not the one I've been living in. But people get in contracts to write those books. There are also the skeptics, as I said. And the skeptics, they basically discount all these claims. They sort of look at the evidence oftentimes. And they also point out the problems of the digital world. And those problems we are somewhat familiar with. They include, among other things, the decline of conversation, interpersonal relations, concern about the quality of human happiness, whether people are actually happier now than they were 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. But the problem with the skeptics and their sort of take on these issues, even though they don't buy what the celebrants are selling, the problem they've got is that they don't offer an alternative. They're like the original skeptics in ancient Greece. They make a criticism, but then they go back to the bar and order another drink. And I think, you know, the idea is you make a criticism and say, how do we understand it and how do we change it to make the world a better place? And that's not a lot of people want to go that direction, and that's the direction I think we desperately need to go. Basically, in Digital Disconnect, and in my work since then, I address, has the internet reformed capitalism and made it more conducive to democracy? And obviously, I think you've got a hint where I'm going with this. The short answer is no. But at the same time, I acknowledge the potential of the technology. I'm not an anti-technologist. My work is not an anti-technology rant. I'm not trying to get rid of the technology, but I'm trying to change the way it's structured and organized and used. And I think that's what we as a society have to do, and I think that'll become more clear as I get into some of these issues. The first place to start is, why do we have the internet? Where did it come from? One of the striking things about the internet is that it's purely a public sector creation. They tried to pawn it off a couple times to AT&T and to private companies. They studied it and said, no thanks, you can't make any money in this thing. You keep it. The Pentagon bankrolled it. It was Pentagon Research that came up with most of the stuff, gadgets you have today comes out of Pentagon Research. From the mouse in your computer to GPS, the whole works. It's all the Pentagon spending. You paid for it. You paid for the R&D for that. You're now paying a company to use it. The internet is a public sector creation. If anything, it's a testament to socialism because there was no money in it for decades. But the interesting story then is what happened. In the 1990s, you see the internet go from being a place that is not only non-commercial, it's anti-commercial. There's strict prohibitions that anything remotely commercial on the internet as late as 1991 or 1992. And those of the old timers like me in the audience remember that. You get flamed if you try to sell your bicycle. Hey, I got on to sell my bicycle, and you get 800 people sending you profanity. This is for citizens. This is for a free society. This wasn't for commercial huckstering. The rest of our society is to shake people down for money. This is one place we can go and be citizens and equals and treat each other decently. That was, believe it or not, that was what it was about. But it changed overnight during the 1990s. How did it do so? What happened? Well, there was a series of policy decisions made in which there was virtually no publicity, no public involvement whatsoever, that basically commercialized the internet and made it what it is today and changed it fundamentally, as you'll see, from what it initially was set up to be. Fundamental changes. And it can be changed again. It can't be. We have the power to do that. It's a policy political question for how we develop it. So what happened in the 1990s? Well, corrupt policymaking was the heart of everything, and there's a really good example of how corrupt the policymaking is. I suspect every one of you has one of these devices. Some of you probably have it grafted onto your hand. And one of the things that's striking is that ISPs and cell phone, internet service provision and cell phones, is this mandatory industry to survive in our society. If you're not connected, you might as well be living in New Guinea. You're just not there. You can't. You're not there. And what's interesting is, remember in the 1990s, there was a lot of talk about an information highway, that there would be a government-created way that everyone would access this the same. So everyone would have access to this, and it would be, this is Al Gore's term before he became vice president, it'd be a free service like the interstate highway system. So you'd have ISP service. You know, they'd buy the wires or rent them from the telecom companies, and we'd have this universal internet. Well, that was a good idea for Senator Al Gore. It didn't look as good when he became Vice President Al Gore. And the big money started saying, hey, we can actually make some bread on this thing. And that's when you saw the huge wave of deregulation that culminated in the 1996 Telecom Act, which loosened the ownership restrictions on telecom companies. And, you know, back in the mid-1990s, people were complaining because there were only 15 to 20 telecom companies delivering telephone, long distance, cable, satellite. They said, well, we need competition. And so all the big companies led by AT&T said, yes, let's get rid of all the ownership limits and let people really compete. And we'll have great competition. And like, these companies want competition? I mean, who fell off the turnip truck? The AT&T is going to pass a law so it can have more competition with it for market share? Of course not. Exact opposite happened. They changed the law, they got rid of the ownership restrictions, and we've seen a spectacular consolidation of the entirety of telecommunication down to four or five companies. Two companies, AT&T and Verizon, have 70% of the market. And it's not even an oligopoly. It's not like the auto industry or the beer industry where two or three companies are competing, or Coke and Pepsi. It's a cartel. Basically, they've divided up the market. They aren't really competing. They've divvied up the market between them. The cable people, the ISPs, the cell phones, there's four or five of them that really dominate, and they aren't competing with each other. They just stopped there. As a result of that, in the United States, we pay far more for a cell phone service than people in almost any other country. Any of you have been to Europe, you know, you say, geez, what's happening? How come you're paying one-tenth what I do in America for this, and it's much better? Well, it's because here our policy is made corruptly by the lobbyists for these handful of companies. And they created a system where they get really rich. They get what economists call rents, monopoly rents, by gouging the public because they own the politicians. And we had this terrible system as a result. And their profits are monopoly profits. The three most valuable companies in American capitalism, the top three are all digital monopolies, all relatively new companies. 5 of the top 8 most valuable companies and 12 of the 32 most valuable companies in the economy are digital powerhouses. You know their names, Google, I guess now it's Alphabet, you know, Microsoft, Apple, Amazon, Facebook, Cisco, and of course AT&T and Verizon, they get in on the ride too. But they're, most of them are what we call monopolies in economic terms. That doesn't mean they sell all the service in a market, but they sell a sufficient amount that they control how much competition they have. They really want to rub someone out, they've got the ability to. But it's usually not in their interest to rub everyone out. Even John D. Rockefeller, at the height of his Standard Oil empire, the monopoly, the greatest monopoly in the history of the industrial world until now, never had more than 80 or 85% of the market share. And he wasn't worth it him to lower his price. It hurt his profits to try to get the whole 100%. So he picked the most profitable point to operate. That's what monopolists do. That's what these guys do. And when you go down that list of most valuable companies, what's striking is there are very few digital giants below the top 32. There's not a middle class. There's not a lot of 80 small entrepreneurs, mid-sized companies. It's basically the giants have everything. They dominate it. Like no other industry's ever dominated capitalism before. Even at the height of the auto industry, to hold a candle to what's going on with American capitalism today in terms of the power and wealth at the top of these digital monopolies. This is sort of a problem for democracy. This sort of concentrated economic power violates any known theory of democracy, not just for the power these individual companies have, and they are unassailable when they have a political interest in Washington, especially when they're united, but also they promote inequality. All the research shows that we have these huge companies owned by a few people, they're going to make a lot more money than everyone else. And it encourages and enhances the inequality that's gotten so much attention. The other two ways that democracy has been compromised by the internet, one I've alluded to already, but it's worth returning to. In the 1990s, part of the promise of the internet was that you would be, you know, you could be anonymous. You controlled your experience. You could pick who knew who you were and who didn't. No one could monitor what you did. That was the power of it. That's why people loved the darn thing. You know, there's that great cartoon in the New Yorker with the dogs at the computer and the internet, no one knows you're a dog. Well, now they all know it's a dog. Those days are long gone because what happened is by the middle of the late 1990s, a marriage of Madison Avenue and corporate America on one hand and the Pentagon and the National Security Agency on the other hand, both said, you know, this internet thing where we don't know where people are, bad for the NSA and the police, really bad for people who want to do advertising because they can't really know who to sell what to. And so they changed the way that the protocol of the internet. And instead of having complete control over your experience, you have no control, really. I mean, whatever you have can be circumvented. And everywhere you go is known. Someone can find it out. It's not a secret. 2 years ago, when I wrote this book, it was a fairly controversial to say that, but thanks to Edward Snowden, now that's not, I don't have to give any more evidence. Everyone gets that. Everyone sees that experience when they go online. But surveillance, this sort of marriage between large corporations, advertisers, and the Pentagon, which is what it is, to do unaccountable surveillance. If you go down the list of great free societies, that's usually not one of the components they have. That people know, spy on you, you don't know about it, and they're unaccountable. That's usually what, you associate that with, you know, the Stasi or something like that. It's a different type of society. And then the one that I've talked about the most is that the internet has basically ended journalism as we know it. It's ended the commercial model of journalism. And what I mean by that is that for the last 125 years, the commercial model of journalism in the United States was advertising supported. The vast majority of the revenues that paid for journalists and reporters and newsrooms came from advertising. Newspapers, it was 60 to 80%, broadcast 100% for a long time. Well, no, you can just erase that money. It's not there anymore. Because today in the digital world, advertisers don't buy ads on websites. They buy ads in ad networks to reach a target demographic. And the news media might hit some of that target demographic, but they're only going to get pennies, not even pennies on the dollars, one-hundredths of pennies on the dollars. And that's why the smart capitalists are basically getting out of the industry altogether. They're selling and jumping ship. As a result of this, journalism is in free fall collapse. We have probably 35%, 40% of the number of working journalists today per capita that we had 25 years ago. Anyone who knows the state capital here, it's true of every state capital in the country, where there used to be 10, 20, 25 working journalists covering politics, there's one or two, if you're lucky. Some states have no working journalists covering their state capital full time. They just sort of send an intern over there, get a press release every now and then. We're in a journalism free zone, and I don't consider talking heads on cable television gossiping about their lame predictions about stupid polls journalism. You know, that, so if you erase that, we're in a definite journalism free zone on television. So this is a real problem that's brought on by capitalism. It can't make money doing it, so we don't get it. Now, that's not to romanticize what had been journalism under advertising. I've been a critic of the great flaws of journalism, but at least he had journalism to criticize. You know, at least he had something there. So this is a dire straits for democracy. This is why we need popular movements to create a democratic infrastructure, to use digital communication to enhance democracy, to address these digital monopolies, this corruption, this surveillance. All the research shows that most Americans are in line with that. They think that's a good idea. It's our dysfunctional political system that prevents that from happening. Now, everything I just talked about is small potatoes. It's really minor stuff compared to what I'm about to talk about. And the stuff I'm about to talk about is the new stuff. And I'll give you a story to put it in context. About 3 months ago in Germany, the CEO of one of the largest industrial corporations in the world was at a private event with $1,000 a bottle of wine for people there of elites in Germany. And he gave the keynote address, and there were people in the audience listening, including one person who was a good friend of mine who was there. That's how I know about this, and it's been corroborated. And after his speech, they had a question and answer period with the audience. And a person in the audience said, you know, we keep hearing about automation and robots and how they're going to affect employment. You know, is there anything to this? And the CEO gave an answer that was jaw-dropping. He said that his company, which is one of the largest companies in the world, already had a fully automated factory, that they had the technology in hand to completely automate all their factories in the world, and that it was economically smart to do so. And he said the only thing holding them back at this point, the reason they had not proceeded to full automation, was that if we did that, and I've got the quote here, it was translated, but if we did that, he said, the middle class in Germany would burn. Basically, so many people would lose their jobs that it would cause a crisis, a social crisis of extraordinary magnitude in Germany. Now, the audience was astounded that he said that, because the implication was real clear. This is coming very soon. We can put our finger in this dike for a while, but it's going to change very soon. This is on the horizon. Now, what he said there that got their attention would not have surprised an audience of computer scientists or engineers who work in these areas. Not at all. And I've had a chance to read a lot of this literature going back to 3, 4, or 5 years now. And there was an extraordinary article published just this summer, right around the same time this CEO gave his talk in Germany, by the program director on robotic research from the Pentagon's Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA. This is the group, basically, that did all the funding that led to the Internet, has bankrolled most of the R&D for the digital world. And they've had a huge project in robotics for the last decade. And this is the guy who oversaw it. And he wrote an article where he's talking about what's coming, what they're able to do, how it's way ahead of anything people knew about just a few years ago. They're solving problems at an exponentially fast rate, and it's going to have immediate impact. But what he did said that was interesting, he said to find the right comparison for how this will affect humanity. You know, forget the printing press. You know, forget being able to speak. You know, he said you've got to go back to the Cambrian explosion to get a sense of what's about to hit humanity. Now, I don't know if anyone in here knows what the Cambrian explosion is. I had to Google it. Oh, I guess that's a trade name. I had to alphabet it. The Cambrian explosion refers to a period 540 million years ago. It was a period in which, in a relatively short period, 10 or 20 million years, we went from very simple life to very complex life. So it wasn't like we have a gradual progress from 3 billion years ago to today in the evolution of life. But rather, it's like this, and then you have this explosion, and you're suddenly at a much higher level with complex life. And it was during the Cambrian explosion that led to what would be the dinosaurs and all that stuff coming down the road, and to us way down the road. But it also things like vision, the ability of animals to see, a living thing to see, that came during this period. And he said, that's what's happening to the world, not just humanity. We're about to enter a Cambrian explosion. This is the guy who's on top of all the research for DARPA, hardly known for being, and he wasn't writing this to raise money for his, IPO for himself or anything. This was a scholarly article. That sort of gets your attention when a guy like that says, this is